Following is an interview with Todd R. Hullin, H-U-L-L-I-N, Administrative Assistant to John D. Ehrlichman. The interview was conducted by Susan Yowell and Jack Nesbitt on Wednesday, October 10th, 1973, in Mr. Hullin's office in the old Executive Office Building. Which...
Can that pick me up from over here?
By no means limited. What we tried to do is to ask people to briefly describe their role on the White House staff or in the administration. The actual job titles mean so little, really. Mm-hmm. From one person to another, they vary so much. And how you saw your job is quite different, maybe, from the way it would be seen by someone else.
Okay.
Obviously, you can't go into any depth on particular areas that you worked on, but maybe outline some of the major policy areas or just where you function.
Okay.
Because we felt that
in the organization,
the whole Ehrlichman operation would have passed through you on its way to John Ehrlichman. I think this should be one of the most informative interviews insofar as the archivist would be concerned.
Knock on wood. Okay.
We were going to do Larry Higbee yesterday, and we got a little postponed because something came up. But I think both of you had that unique role of being.
Well, one thing we're looking for is the functional relationship with individuals within an office, and then too with outside that immediate office and how you relate it to the other offices and the executive office. So, why don't I start by asking, when did you actually join the staff?
I came on in June of 1969. I was on, I'd completed 2 years of military service, and I had extended for 3 months. And during that 3 month extension, I met with John and Bob one afternoon. I had known of them previously. And he said, why don't you come down and we'll go to work? And I started in June, the day after I met with him.
That was before the domestic council.
It's true. He was counsel for the president. Time.
And you were going to be his administrative aide?
Well, I was going to come in and work on special projects for him, and which I did initially until we had a much smaller staff then, which I did, you know, in terms of casework and things, you know, revolving around casework and his specific requirements for a given day. And the job really evolved into an administrative assistant's position. He had two or three people doing what I ended up doing as when I became his executive assistant.
Were there particular projects in this casework that you handled?
No, those were primarily, you know, doing briefing papers, doing a lot of his dictation, memos to the president, memos to the staff, communicating with the staff. I viewed an administrative position like that as while involved in substance, it was primarily one of administration and communication and coordination. And we were dedicated, as we were all as a staff, to the president. We were dedicated to John, trying to maximize his time. He had such a broad, even as counsel, spectrum of responsibilities that his time was highly important. And we did our best not to waste his time. So we tried to bring things to him in as simple a way as possible and try to make the issue as presented to him as briefly as we could in the depth that he needed to make the decision on whether it should go to the president or back to a cabinet officer or just how that would work.
When he was counsel, was that done mostly through briefing papers or was it done verbally?
When we presented issues to him, mostly it was done, it's hard. Internally, we would meet with our staff all the time. We had staff meetings in the morning and various meetings with individuals during the day, and so it would be done orally in that sense. When it got really complex, if you're talking about an education bill or, you know, when we got into the welfare reform debates and things like that, those very complex issues had to be laid out on paper. We tried to do as much as we could of the heavy stuff. I would guess just about all of the heavy stuff is done on paper, unless you're the administrative tactics, legislation, and strategy, and things like that could be on a telephone call. we tried to keep it as much as we could on paper. We found it a helpful discipline to force people to put their reasoning on paper. And it does a couple of things. First, it helps them logically present their thoughts, and it tends to eliminate the personal salesmanship of an individual. If you will bring two cabinet officers together with different points of view on the same issue, and you really were asking them to debate, you're really weighing in a factor that's not fair, and that's the personality of the individual debating. And in recent experience, you know, it'd be tough for anybody to go into a debate with John Connie. So, and this is, I think, also part of the Ash report, and the unwritten portion of it, going into reorganization and the founding of the Domestic Council, we're finding a way that cabinet officers and agency heads can present their views to the president without necessarily taking his time for him only to hear one point of view. We get into the old time argument of how should the president use his time? The cabinet officer says on a given issue, I want to come in and talk to him. Well, fine. He's maybe one of four cabinet officers with a specific responsibility or policy impact in a given issue area. Well, the president has to decide then, well, do I listen to this one cabinet officer and then give the other three each individual time? Or do I listen to them all together? And this is the kind of approach we had to take. And basically, it boils down to, if you listen to them one at a time, it takes an awful lot of time to have them tell you what you probably already know from your staff and from their staff, what their position is and why they're there. So other than a stroking session, I don't think that's a particularly valuable point or a valuable use of time for any decision maker early in the decision making process. The other option being, let's have them all in and we'll just sit around a table and we'll just argue. Well, then you just really get into, you know, what kind of decisions are made in the heat of debate. And you weigh in the personality factors, and which we didn't find being very helpful. So the way we tried to work it with the president in our operation was to, and John was really kind of the honest broker. As he emerged, it was the honest broker thing, because we had Moynihan on one side and Burns on the other side of most issues, and they were lobbying the socks off the president. So, you know, he kind of looks to, Jesus, somebody pull this together. You know, I can't, you know, I don't know who's telling me what, and so forth and so on, and they'd shoot things in. So it really became a system, as the Domestic Council emerged, of bringing to the president all of the thoughts, first the issue, or the problem, and in some cases they're synonymous, whether it's a presidential issue or a departmental issue, and then all the options available to the president in addressing that issue, and all the thoughts and recommendations, etc., from the appropriate members of the cabinet and the administration on that issue, laying out all the pros and cons, the costs of every argument, and just saying you have four options, and here's the pros of the first argument, the cons of the first argument, and here's who recommends that argument. Number two. And go and just go through the whole thing and lay out also a little background section so he has a feel for what the issue is. And you can see this from the decision papers that go to the president. They're pretty much that way. Then after the president had gone through one of his papers, we get in. Then he comes back. Rarely will he decide off one of those papers. Then he comes back with notes in the margins and stuff like that. And he can probe these people. And I think it's probably the best way to make a decision in government is giving all the competing elements. And there's a way for outside interest groups to be plugged in, for the Congress, congressional input, cabinet input, White House staff input, everybody. And at the time you're bringing in all that input, you're not taking the president's time, which is really the most valuable thing we have here to try to preserve and work with. And so as that's how Ehrlichman operated in terms of the Domestic Council, we try to do the same thing for him, only we would be much more free with his time in terms of meeting with the cabinet officers and making sure that they felt that their input was there. And we would show them the options paper, saying, that's what we plan to send to the president. Are you fairly reflected in there? And they'd say, yes. or if no, I'd like these changes. And if they weren't, you know, if the changes were meritorious, we'd say fine. We could say that's a gratuitous, you know, that's a lobby. You're saying, you know, it's an unverified conclusion. We're trying to keep the paper very objective. And there's a political input. There's no, we're not kidding anybody. There's a significant political input that goes into all decision papers. And my function as it evolved with John was one in counsel, even when he was counsel, and I became his administrative assistant. Was one of bringing things to him basically two or three times a day, as they would either come through phone messages, personal visits to me, or in memo form, issues for his decision, or issues that I felt are information for his, for him, that I felt he had to have before he continued his day. And so it was a matter of communication from others to him, and communication back from him to others, so that he wouldn't have to take the time to dictate, he wouldn't have to take the time to get into a telephone conversation and so forth. And we could give pretty quick guidance and get rapid response, and I would not hesitate to interrupt him anywhere to get, if I felt the issue merited it, to get his response or to get guidance for our people, give it a, that they needed to have and heard. So I would bring to him all of the incoming material or information once, twice a day, depending on, primarily we tried to wrap up at night, give us the time to go through the whole day activities and also prepare for the morning activities, or the, you know, the next day. And then this evolved more and more as he became, in 71 when he became the assistant to the president for domestic affairs, when we had a much, we had a larger staff then, he was given all of the domestic thing, really. And so our agency contacts were more more complex and more thorough. We always had the OMB or the budget people on you know, as doing agency work, and we had our staff doing agency work, and to coordinate that took a lot. And I thought it worked out very well. So I was bringing to him, our day would start, maybe if I ran through a day, it would show you how we try to organize ourselves in terms of getting programming, not programming him, but giving him information as best we could. We would meet for breakfast with him every morning at 7. And that was basically Ken Cole, who was our, kind of our staff director of the substantive side, and I was kind of the administrative director. Ken Cole and I would sit down with John at breakfast and basically go through the issues of the day as we saw them very rapidly, and would be reading and reacting to the newspapers. By the time John got in, which was usually 10 of 7, something like that, he had been through pretty much the morning paper, the Washington Post, and pretty much through the news center for the things that he felt that he had to react to or that the president was going to ask him about, et cetera, et cetera. So then we would get what he felt, he would ask us what he felt he needed, and we had a given amount of time to get it to him. And we would exchange information on a basis like that, going through the schedule, do you have, you know, what do we want to do with different people and so forth. And as he would go into these other staff meetings, which would go from about 7:30 to 9:30 every morning, you know, do you have the information you need to cope with the problems that are going to come up in these other staff meetings? So that breakfast usually lasted for about 30 minutes. At 7:30, we went up to a meeting in the Roosevelt Room, which included all of our domestic council staff, the top people in the Office of Management and Budget, our congressional people, and representatives from various offices in the White House, from council, CEA, Flanagan's office was represented, all kinds of different people, which is basically a congressional session whereby the congressional people would give us an update on what had happened on the Hill yesterday and what was going to happen today. And they would get guidance. The meeting was chaired jointly by Schultz and Ehrlichman. And they would get this is when George was director of the Office of Management and Budget. And they would get joint guidance and how to play themselves, and then we had our substantive guys there and the OMB substantive guys there, and so they would be able to marry and get together on an issue and give the guidance to our congressional people that they needed to guide our efforts on the domestic side. John would then go from that meeting to an 8:15 meeting in Haldeman's office with the Kissingers and the Haldemans and the Schultzes and that crowd. And so this 7:30 was really a preparation for the 8:15 meeting, which they discussed the president today and, you know, what are the things that he was going to be doing, and should there be any changes, the events of the day, should we make any changes and so forth, and how should we play this and so forth and so on. So then he would break from that at whenever it ended, 9 o'clock, said. It was a 45 minutes to an hour meeting. And then we would start his schedule. That was standard. The 7, 7:30, and 8:15 are standard every day, 5 days a week. On Saturdays we had breakfast usually, but we didn't have the 7:30 big meeting. Then we would start his schedule, and we would be frugal with his time. Much of his time recognized was needed just to study the issues and the decision papers that were coming to him. So we tried not just to throw his time away without some justification. But he was scheduled usually for somewhere between, 5 and 10 meetings a day, varying in length from 10 minutes to, to 2 hours. And hopefully we would not get into many 2-hour sessions. And we would program his lunch, schedule his lunch if we found it would be useful. And try to give him breaks in the day to prepare for just prior to big meetings, especially the heavy meetings. You can cover, just drop-bys, visits, stroking sessions, things like that, without much preparation. Meetings involving domestic substance on issues and guidance for domestic council committees and things like that, he had to have time to prepare. And so we tried to program him into a schedule too. And then at the end of the day, somewhere between 6:30 and 8, let's say, Ken and I would go in and cover the day with him. All the incoming material that I hadn't covered with him at an earlier time, from action items to priority reading items to his personal mail and his scheduling, etc., everything like that. It evolved that as I got more and more into the communication and coordination of John's substance, that Jana Haruska, who was his secretary, took over more and more of the administrative duties. That being coordination of his schedule and walking. I had the approval of John's schedule. He had the ultimate approval, obviously, but I would approve his schedule. She did all the mechanics of setting it up, and she would, as things developed, would take on approving meetings on his schedule on her own. Setting them up. She did all of his personal mail, which at times was very large, and just took too much time. I just didn't have time to review all of that. John did a lot of traveling, not a lot of traveling. He always traveled with the president when he traveled domestically. But when he traveled separately, we programmed him pretty heavily in terms of press conferences, media appearances, speeches, meetings with opinion makers in given areas and things like that. That required a good deal of advance work. It started out that I did most of that advance work on my own from my office as part of my job as his assistant. On really heavy trips where we were going to be gone for a number of days and hitting a number of states on given issues, we would use an advance man from Ron Walker's office or take a guy off our staff saying, we're going to draft you away from your substantive job for 3 days and you're going to go out and play advance man. Which is a tough job. And advancing a trip is an awfully tough job. And then on the shorter trips, it ended up that Jana would do all of the setting up of our airplanes and cars and people and hotels and things like that. I always traveled with him. Jana would travel with us on occasion, whereas especially if we felt if we were running behind and we had to have speech drafts typed on the plane or things like that where we were or in the hotel room. Or if we felt a specific need for secretarial work that we did not want to try and draft a steno typist from either the hotel or from the local Republicans or something like that. So she, more and more as we got in, I would say the last 18 months or the last 2 years, the last 18 months were 2 years, I guess, took more and more of the administrative things over, and I worked closer and closer with Kim on the substantive things, in addition to just domestic policy, which John was responsible for pulling together. He viewed himself as an honest broker, as I explained earlier, bringing all the options to the president. And he wouldn't reflect himself in these papers unless the president asked him to. And he was kind of sitting up saying, here's what all your experts think. He was being asked to get all the experts in and out of government to focus on a given issue. And the president asked him, obviously having been through it in great detail, the president would say to him, John, what do you think? Or, John, make sure, I want to know what you think. Of course, then of course it would be included. But he tried to posture himself very carefully as an honest broker, in a sense, and not trying to lobby the president one way or the other. And not letting anybody else lobby him one way or the other. But, you know, try it as close as possible to make the decision on the merits.
What about when something was not presented as a formal option paper? Was there any documentation
to whom?
Staff meetings that you had, the internal staff meetings that you had with Ken Cole and Mr. Irwin and yourself?
There were. I don't know. I can't really answer the question. I took notes of my meetings with Irwin and Cole primarily as action items. We would sit down and we would get a number of decisions or things of guidance from John, and which needed to be communicated to either, well, to both members of our staff, members of the OMB people, and cabinet people, be they cabinet officers or their assistant secretaries and undersecretaries. My notes were basically, you know, tell so-and-so this or communicate this. This is the direction I want to pursue, things like this. The president would like to see the following items, you know, those kinds of things. Once I had completed that list of notifications, I generally did away with my notes. That's unfortunate, and I didn't really realize that until I just constantly kept before me an action list of things I had to do before a given deadline. And as I got them, once I checked them off and done it, I knew that that which I had relayed would be coming back to us in terms of memo form primarily, unless it was, you know, call somebody on the Hill and say that, okay, we're willing to give on this or we're not willing to give on that. But most of my action items were of a communication kind of thing, or, you know, do a memo for Ehrlichman signature to the president, you know, on crime increases or, you know, DC home rule or things like that. Which I wouldn't necessarily have to do myself, but I would have our staff people do, and then I would review for his signature before presented to him. So most of those things are recorded in terms of paper documentation, in terms of the final product, stepping the way of, you know, logging all my phone calls and things like that. No, I don't have it, or even he didn't keep notes of acceptance, you know, like I did, action items of meetings other than with the president. He has a very complete set of notes of his meetings with the president, which are in the president's file. But if he sat down and met with, you know, a couple of cabinet officers to talk about, the Maritime Commission, we would always have a staff guy there, one of our staff guys there on the substance of the issue. If he was talking a substantive issue, we would primarily have a staff guy there, either me or Cole, or preferably the guy who has that area of responsibility in terms of substance. He would be the guy to take the notes and the follow through and to make sure all the questions were covered so that we wouldn't have to come back and use more of Ehrlichman's time again to ask or re-ask questions or re-answer questions. So the documentation, I think there is documentation from other staff people who run the domestic counseling staff, or perhaps even an R&B, because we would often include the Dick Nathans or Paul O'Neill or Bill Morrill or somebody like that in our meetings. If nobody was sitting in and it was something that I felt was of substance, I would try to plug Ken or myself into it. But that was rare. I would much prefer to have plugged somebody into it who had the responsibility for the issue. Not only was it make more sense, because he had more knowledge of the issue than I did, but it also gave them even a greater exposure to John, which I felt was important.
Was there a formal memorandum to files as, say,
limited
residence file done for subsequent meetings?
Not unless there were meetings with the president. And like we used to, there's a system, like, again, on that cabinet meeting. Now, if he had a meeting with two cabinet officers, or just one cabinet officer, we did not do a memorandum to file. We did not, or rarely. We may have, John may have dictated a memorandum back to a member of his staff, or to the council, or whoever had the responsibility for a given issue, saying, I've just met with the Attorney General, and, you know, the crime problem in D.C. is really severe, and we think we ought to pursue it in this way in terms of legislation and trying to mobilize some federal help here for the District of Columbia, or, you know, something. That's a fictitious example, but he would dictate not a memorandum for file, but a memorandum to somebody to get something done. So there is a record in that sense, but saying, here's a record of my meeting with so-and-so, no. And I think, and I'll add this as a gratuitous remark, I think that I found that upon John's resignation, that we found we had very good documentation of his meetings with the president. Very good. We did not have good documentation of his, and we knew who he met with. His schedule was absolutely firm and final, down to the minute. But what went on in all of those meetings, no. And that is something I would urge that others correct. And the same thing with telephone. We did not have an accurate telephone log. In fact, we had to finally do away with it. He was an individual who would call people on his own. He'd just pick up his I.O. and talk to people. And if he didn't particularly want to tell us that he had made that call or what was said, we didn't know about it. And, you know, we could record incoming cabinet officer calls or congressional calls or press calls or things like that. But if we didn't have an ability, or he could just punch the White House operator and say, you know, give me the Attorney General or give me Secretary Finch or whoever it was. And if we were not in on that and know what the subject of the conversation was, then we're, you know, our phone record was a real disaster because it was incomplete. One point I was trying to touch on earlier was, in addition to our substantive involvement for John and domestic counsel staff, John was, I don't know what the term is, but he was very close to the president. And he did things, and he and the president talked about things that were not domestic policy. The family estates, you know, his estate plan, the president's will, you know, it's things like that. They would cover the soup to nuts thing in terms of a presidential meeting, maybe 70% of it was focusing on, you know, our legislation before the Hill or on domestic policy papers in development. But there's always a 30%, well, should we call it a BS quotient, or something in there that often required his attention, or, you know, him to make calls or follow through, things like that. And in those cases, you know, he was pretty much, you know, if he wanted me to do it, that was my function. If he got an order from the president, it was a waste of his time to do it if I could do it. So I could execute orders from the president without a problem if there were communications or do a memo or get a memo or get me some information or stuff like that. Ehrlichman didn't have to do that. He he relayed it to Cole or to me, and we'd get it done for him. You know, usually he needed it the day before he asked for it, and we would get it as rapidly as we could. But there are a number of things that I'm sure, which I don't know about, because he just, you know, would operate between Richard Nixon and John Ehrlichman, that he handled on the telephone with people, and you know, that we were unable to really keep our hands on his special relationship, the special relationship he had with the president. And but in terms of the substance, the development of policy papers, and things like that, my hunch is, as you go through the files of our staff people, I think you'll find not an all-inclusive, but a pretty good, pretty complete record of how the decision papers were put into being, the meetings, the telephone calls, and all the way up to the final decision, the presidential message, and the submission of legislation, and, you know, in some cases, you know, revenue sharing, etc., all the way down to the signing ceremony in Philadelphia. And I think, you know, those are the kinds of things you're interested in. Those are not available on carte blanche, you know, for every issue. I wish they were. And I think that it would be helpful if people coming into the administration would understand, or someone should tell them, that a record of events is highly critical. Now, most cabinet officers keep, you know, very, very close tabs of things, but they've just got thousands of people running around that do nothing else but keep tabs on them. And in the staff here, where everybody is working to, you know, they're putting out 110% level, but they need 130% in order just to keep up with the paperwork that comes to them. They don't have time to totally document all those things that go on. We always used to get the request to say, you have just met with the president, and Arthur Burns on the economy. Would you do a memorandum for the president's file that said what happened? Well, you know, he's an awfully busy guy. Now, that takes 15 minutes of his time to sit down and dictate those things. Now, I bet when he left the White House, there were probably, you know, 300 of those things undone by him. But he had an incredibly accurate record of his own personal notes, which he said that these, and which are, I think, legible. You know, some of them were televised during the Watergate hearings, and they are legible. You had to get interpretation from them. I would go through those notes, you know, the ones he let me see. He said, there's some things in here that I've got to follow through on, flagging for me because I haven't got time right now. And I could pretty much figure out which ones, you know, he would make some note during the conversation, an action or a start or something, or note well or something, that I would flag and say, okay, here are the things we got to go through that I've seen. Now, what else in there jogs your memory? And we would try to go through the notes where we get all the action items down. So his presidential notes offer an accurate record. But he was so busy that he was the only man who could dictate from the notes that he took. And I could get general guidance from him. But I could, no way could I, you know, because either were one or two word phrases. No way could I get the thrust of a conversation. So he was the only guy that could do it. His time was so eaten up just by the pressures of the day and his own schedule that he just didn't have time to do this. And that's unfortunate, but fortunately he does have an accurate record of his notes. I think it's beneficial for people to come in, which I'm doing now. Any meeting I sit in, this one being an exception, not the only one I can recall, I take notes of what, you know, who I'm meeting with, when, time, place, basically why. And then the notes reflect the thrust of the conversation. I do that on telephone calls. And then I just file them. And I may never use them again. If there are action items in there, of course I use them. But if they're not, they're just there. And someday maybe I'll recall. If not, they just go, you know, they're just part of my files, and they'll go, you know, somewhere. Nothing overwhelming, but just if I'm working down the housing area, if I talk to Lynn or his undersecretary or any of his staff, I record it. Only on my, just on a legal tablet, rip it out, and then Jana keeps a file on those things. That can be done by just about everybody. That doesn't take any time. And if you're sitting in a meeting, there's no reason you can't take a couple of notes and just jot down the thrust of the conversation. But to have a guy, unless you're going to assign somebody specifically to the Lairds and the Higgs and the Haldemans and the Ehrlichmans and the Harlows and all these crowd, all that crowd, they go at such a fantastic pace that there's no way that they don't necessarily see until it's too late the value of documentation. They go too fast to document. It's got to be documented for them. I think that's true of the cabin officer, but they have, you know, the cabin officer can't make a call out. He's got to make a call through his girl so she knows. You know, and we don't, you know, we can't tab, you know, when he's talking on an IO or when he just picks up the phone, which was his habit of calling, just using the White House operator. Well, that makes it tough for us because the White House operators don't keep logs and find out. And, or if they do, they're not complete because they didn't, some of them try to pursue it. So that's, you know, we try to, I think everybody, and I guess, I don't know if that's your job, Jack, or not, but somebody's got to talk to these people when they come in.
Talking, we really tried with the 3 years I've been here to work on something, but this hectic pace does work against us.
That's
I think
right.
We're better off than previous administrations, but still.
There's no, and there again, and I, you know, like, if I were a male lawyer, my, and our, you know, keeping the records like I do now, they're not good. But at least they say that I made these phone calls, or not made these calls, but these are the people I talked to. I got through to, or they got through to me. And this is what we did. And basically, even if it's just the subject matter, that's helpful. You know, we discussed, you know, the 1939 Social Security Act, or just, you know, re-Social Security. That's helpful. It seems to me that would be helpful to you. But there's very little of that done. I think it's just, I don't know of many people who keep complete records. And I think, you know, this Watergate thing showed it up. We tried to reconstruct things in terms of issues, what was going on, and so forth and so on. And I know John tried to do it. His most valuable guy was presidential notes. That was the key thing for him, and that was the most complete, accurate record we had. And plus his schedule, which, you know, because Jana did it, it was, you know, and she's good, and there was just a standard operating procedure on his schedule, how things got on it, and such things got scratched so often, keeping his schedule up. You know, his schedule would change, you know, 4 to 10 times a day, because we would get preempted by the president. People would have to be moved. Something would come up, you know, scratch here, put him somewhere else. That we had a proposed schedule every day. We had a 2 to 6 month schedule, looking at trips or things that could be scheduled way out. And then as the schedule changed each day, it was as proposed and then actually as completed. And at the end of each day, she typed who went into his office, when, and when they came out. And so his schedule, who he saw, is accurate. We were unable to put forward. I talked to him a number of times about saying, you know, it's easier on you if you just ask Jana or any of the girls in the office to place a call for you. It also gives us a record of, you know, and so forth. But, you know, the girls would be on the phone or they'd be out moving around or he'd have them on a crash type of Friday and he wouldn't want to bother them. So he just looked, you know, you'd be IO, it's easy to talk to anybody you want on the staff. And the White House operator, you can get anybody at any time, any place in the world.
Right.
You know, they're fantastic. And so he found that a very handy device because they, especially if you're talking to cabinet officers at the Hill, you know, they just plug right in. So,
I just have a question in terms of the number of IO contacts. Did he have a very large number of these direct lines?
No. Well, that's a good point. It touches on a couple of things. First, he was so busy that we wouldn't let him answer his IO. Basically, we shut the bell off. And on that basis, if he wanted to use it, he could. If it rang, I'd answer it or Janet would answer. Now, that's because guys would nickel-dime me, you know, or they try to end-run our staff people, even on our staff here. I'm talking the whole staff as opposed to the domestic council staff. Now, rather than work through a Cole or a Holland or somebody like that, again, trying to bring all of the points to bear, somebody would try to reach him directly in his IO and lobby him. think, geez, I really got to have this, and if I don't have it, oh my God, everything's going to go to hell. You know, if he wants to relay that message to me, fine, but then I can call the guy who's got the issue, and I said, okay, now what's the other side of this? And, you know, we try to bring some balance, again, trying to, in my job, trying to be as honest as I could at bringing all the points of view into him, for him to give the guidance, or go to the president and get the guidance. Touches on the phone thing. He did have what we call PLs, which are direct lines, which were used with some frequency. He had a PL to Holden, which they constantly talked on, which is, you know, basically you punch, and you just punch a bunch of pickup and it rings in Bob's office. Now, Bob had the same system we did. He didn't answer his IO. So, and he had two PLs, one to Ehrlichman, one to the president. We had a couple of more because we had to deal. We had one to Schultz, who was director of the Office of Management Budget. Well, the OMB contact with us was essential. And George and John got along very well, so it was something we did. We had, you know, there was a one-way PL to us from the president. Otherwise, you know, he could pick up and it would ring like a fire alarm in his office. But it's not like we could punch at John's end and talk to the president. I mean, it was a, you know, if John wanted to talk to the president on the phone, he'd have to go through the White House operator.
We knew the president's log, and we get the calls that are logged by the switchboard. What we don't have any record of would be calls to Ruth Woods or John Ehrlichman. Now, out of curiosity for our own information, would we have missed a lot of calls?
I mean, if he picked up that PL in his office?
From the president to John Ehrlichman.
Yeah. He would have. I would guess. I can't give you an average, but minimum. You know, and their averages are so distorting. Minimum once a day. Sometimes 10 times. I mean, you know, it was just very easy. And if he was somewhere other than his Oval Office or the EOB, of course he'd go to the Signal Board or the White House Board or whoever.
That's what we would get, though.
You would get those. That's not a problem. If he called from Camp David or something like that, that's not a problem.
Anything goes through switchboard.
Right.
But we wouldn't get the Rose Woods, the John Ehrlichman, or the Bob Holmes from the Oval Office. That
right.
Because of these.
Right.
One way out. Going.
I don't know. You'd have to check with Larry. Now, those would be reflected in John's notes, though. In his notes, yes. Any conversation you have with the president. Put down, unless it was like, you know, going through a receiving line in church or something. And even then, if he told him to do something, he would jot it down. But usually on a little 3x5 card or something like that. And but those pretty much, and he'll put like, you know, he'll put the time and date, a telephone conversation with the president, and PH, which means phone call. And you know, again, the one or two word phrases that what he needs to recall, what he needs to know from that conversation, and do what he has to do, and then, you know, we would take it and put it in a file, and that was when he resigned and went down to Trudy's office. But you would miss, and I would guess with Henry, too. Well, Henry kept very accurate logs. As I understand, Henry kept a complete phone log, as I've talked to his assistants, and we all kind of, you know, I would talk to the David Youngs or the Dick Campbells or, you know, Coleman Hicks, all these guys, and to Larry, and to, we would try to say, you know, how do you work it? How do you try to keep control of what they do? Or how can you better help organize them? We'd try to, you know, help each other. And but you're still basically a function of the guy for whom you're working. And so at times, it's, you know, some guys submit to certain things in terms of recording events, or telephone calls and things like that, and recording. Very sensitive about that. I mean, writing them down. I don't mean tape, but and others just don't submit to it. You know, I mean, you know, they don't think of it. They go so fast that they, you know, if John would have thought that, gee, you know, it'd be nice to know maybe who I talk to, you know, 6 years from now. Well, I mean, that's just, you know, who cares who I talk to 6 years from now? I mean, you get. I want to talk to him, and I've got to go now. I got 15 minutes to get it done. If I don't talk to him now, it's going to be tomorrow morning. And you know, it's, you know, you really gotta move like that. And that's unfortunate, because I think the records, while probably, and I think you're right, Jack, that they're probably better than any other administration. I think they'll be, it's still, you know, a degree incomplete. You've been helped considerably by the formation of the, as I know it, the domestic council, because policy decisions are made, and also through the way this president works. He works better off the written page, which for you is a benefit. With Johnson, it was kind of a consensus agreement and who touched him last. And, you know, there was no way to know exactly who got to him or what was said, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you do have the discipline of the policy decision memos that, that go in with all agencies reflected and all concerned, you know, from his assistants to his counselors to his cabinet officers, which I think you'll have a better record of the policy development or the policies he developed in his 8-year term than any other president.
Again, you really can't make too close generalizations, but on this other 30% of Mr. Olin's contact with the president, which was not concerning domestic policy.
I'm just wagging at that percentage.
Could you estimate, and not necessarily in numbers, but could you estimate the extent to which he continued to serve as a counsel to the president?
Counsel as attorney, SEL?
Right.
I think he worked with it. Yeah, I think, you know, I think he did, he was consultant. I mean, like on the president's tax side. You know, I thought Herb Kalmbach's firm did that. And John didn't clear it or anything, but he was just kind of there and knew about it. You know, was kind of, he was a lawyer, the lawyer closest to the president than probably anybody, so, you know, he knew about things like that. The estate plan, he knew about things like that.
The Nixon Foundation.
The Nixon Foundation, you know, and we've got, and as a trustee of the Nixon Foundation, you know, we've been down to Austin to take a look at the library. What do you do down there? And to Harry Middleton, and we've been briefed by him, and Harry's been up here. You know, how are you working? If you had to do it over again, and Harry's been very honest with us, he's saying there's some things we really did wrong. But those kinds of things, you know, there were just a number of little things, or, you know, listening to friends of the president for the president. You know, sometimes listening to Beebe. Or, you know, doing things that, you know, just saying, and because Beebe wouldn't pick the president's mind. He was, you know, that's, I think that's why he's so valuable to the president, is they just can spend great amounts of time together and just be close personally and not have to do any kind of professional dialogue. And so John, if Beebe had an idea that he felt was worth pursuing, or he said, hey, you know, run this. And there are other people, you know, Walter Annenberg's, who's an ambassador, you know, he had a great feel for things in this country too. And he, you know, as a newspaper man, and he knew Philadelphia very well, and he knew the political scene up there and so forth. John would talk to him. And there are a number of people like that who, you know, John, will you see this guy for me and so forth and so on. Because I, you know, I really don't want to get into it. And Bob, I'm sure, would do that also.
One thing we've experienced since the departure of the two of them, we just haven't sensed anybody throwing the vacuum in our own area of interest. Library, future library, and planning for that.
And I think that's unfortunate. I hope it'll come. I think it's just, you know, we've all been shaken. And now everybody's just, we're, you know, the ship of state is running well, but it's, you know, there are a lot of little things that, that we need to do to refocus on or to focus more on and things like that. And the library is one of them. It's the library is kind of like the bicentennial, you know. Nobody wants to think about it until January 1st, 1976. And then all of a sudden, oh my God. I mean, you started talking to people about the bicentennial in 1971, and they could have cared less. And now they're saying, gee whiz, 3 years. We can't possibly get it done in 3 years. You know, and that's, you're gonna get, it's gonna be feast or famine all of a sudden, you know. Couple of years, it's going to be feast, and everybody's going to say, "My God, we got to have a library. What are we doing?" And I think once we get over, you know, get Watergate out of the headlines, and get, you know, get some answers, and get that settled, and get it out, you know, at least lower visibility in terms of the American public's perception, I think we'll be able to get back onto things like that. I think Al Hagel obviously have to take a lead in it, and you know, Garment. and others, because there's, you know, the land and all that stuff. It's gonna be difficult. And I think the Nixon Foundation will have to, I can't tell you the last time they met.
Well, they met in January, but it was a rather pro forma thing, I think. In conjunction with an article, we had Nixon presented.
Oh, yeah, slides, I remember that.
Three locations, and I think John Dean was...
John Dean was very, as counsel, was doing a lot of the, you know, the land viewing, and geez, how do we get there from here, kind of a thing. And so he was doing a lot of that, and it required that he work closely with Kalmbach, and who was, you know, on board and so forth. So he was doing a lot of that work.
John Campbell, would he have functioned under you with the mechanical aspects?
Basically, well, he really worked for Cole. But John Campbell and I worked very closely together. John was the administrative officer of the domestic council, for lack of a better term, in terms of personnel, salaries, things like that. Also, he was our staff secretary, as it were, whereby we get something and we need to know what our staff guys think of it now. John, get their answers. You know, he was a coordinator and a communicator and so forth within in-house also, in talking to you know, OMB, the press office, and tying a lot of things together. Or we would bring together a message at the last, you know, but at the last minute, all of a sudden you've got a draft message that everybody signed off on, you know. How do we get it from that piece of paper, you know, to the press? How do you print it? You know, to whom do you take it? Who types the stencils? Who runs the stencils? Where are the final copies? How do we get them to the press office? Who do we have to get them to first? How do we get them to the Hill? You know, all of these kinds of things. And where's the legislation? And John was a superb detail man. He did a lot of that. He did it all. And I can't think of anybody who could do it quite as well as he did. He had his tap on just about, you know, he had the heartbeat of this place, and he knew how to get things done when it totally stumped everybody else. But again, primarily administrative stuff. He was given some special projects by Kent, and he was given some special projects by Ehrlich. But
what was your relationship to Evans and John Baker?
Very close. Worked very closely with them, and I still consider them very close friends.
Did you get involved that deeply in any policy areas, substantive?
Only at a later stage. I was kind of a, they would present things to John to be presented to the president. I would always, these are in writing, I would review those in advance along with Ken and basically say, reading it like I would be reading it for the first time, as Ehrlichman would probably be reading it for the first time unless we had gone through several drafts. And I could say from that, there's not enough there for anybody to make a decision. Or I think you've left out some options. And I would just try to ask some of the very tough but very simple questions. I would get into a lot of things at a later time. Ken would do a lot of that too. And Ken and I would work closely on, you know, does this really have to go to John? And, you know, it almost gets to a point where once you have an issue that's outstanding, and after you've done all of your staffing, you've got three options, and everybody recommends option two, then is it really presidential? I mean, does it have to go to the president? That's a tough call. But there are times when they're like, no, let's just go with it. And Ken can make those decisions, or John can make those decisions. And my God, everybody agrees. Those other two we just can't do for the budgetary reasons, you know, economic reasons or political reasons. That's the decision. Go with it. And the president was very good at delegating to John, to Bob, and to Henry, and to George. They're giving them the responsibility of making some of those decisions for him. And I think he made it very clear early that this president did not want to be nickel-dimed together to death. That there are a lot of small decisions that for some reason or other, because and they're the only the tough ones come into the White House. If they're easy, the cabinet has to make it. And so, and if they want to cover their tail or collect their, or protect their political flank, they say, oh, Jesus, the White House got to make that decision. You know, so they send those things. They're all, like, a lot of them are nickel dimes. And they don't really require the president's time. Again, we get back to the president's time thing. We were dealing at a time when the president was highly concerned with Vietnam. And a lot of his time and a lot of his energy had to go there. And at the same time, he had to deal with major domestic initiatives, welfare reform, revenue sharing, general revenue sharing, special revenue sharing, reorganization of the entire government. At a time when we were getting a great deal of hostility in the press and in the streets and in the Congress and in the bureaucracy. And so I think this president has been superb at focusing, keeping his eye on the big ball and not getting clubbed in the ass with a bunch of little balls, and giving the responsibilities to those key assistants, counselors, and cabinet officers to say, you know, you bring to me what you think has to come to me, but don't nickel dime me.
You were involved at the beginning and the end in defining the issue and then in seeing the decision was finally made.
Mm-hmm. And then communicating the decision. And then we get into the real problem of that any administration faces, which is enforcing a policy decision or bringing a policy decision into being. And you would think that once the President of the United States has made a decision, that, bam, you know, the wheels start turning. Well, for a young country boy, I found out that just ain't so. And it's a real education to watch guys in the bureaucracy go 180 degrees away from a presidential direction. And you got to be saying, he just didn't hear us. Yeah. And that's not the case. He heard you. He just didn't agree with you. And so that's, you know, then you get it. In addition to the policy formation business, you get into the policy enforcement business. Now, that's often called management. Now, that was one of the reasons that you brought in the Office of Management and Budget. We did not have an effective arm to run around and say, okay, the president's decided this. Now, that means these things, and let's do it. And let's go stand and with those, you know, and the cabinet officers. And not that the cabinet officers were running away from us. We're looking further down into a bureaucracy. I think we've had a very high level of cabinet officer and undersecretary and political appointees, basically. But you're talking about 10 guys in a department of, you know, 22,000. And, but, it's, you know, as those things are communicated and you get them out to the field office in VA in Phoenix, Arizona, son of a gun, they're just not doing it the way the president had hoped they would be watching out for the Vietnam veteran. So you've got to follow it right down the line. And we watched it in terms of presidential policy decisions, the drafting of legislation, the passing and signing of legislation, then putting that legislation into being and into enforcing it. Well, legislation is really enforced through a series of regulations which are written by the same bureaucrats over the departments that sometimes are against us. And those regulations are really the nut crunchers. You know, you can interpret a piece of legislation a number of different ways, and it's interpreted through those regulations. And those regulations require that local offices, regional offices, and field offices do certain things. And they can turn the entire policy direction of a presidential decision around through a regulation. Well, you got to get a handle on that. And that's the M in OMB. And I don't think we are doing it yet. But we're doing it a hell of a lot better than anybody else has. And recognizing that we're doing things that are a little more difficult at times for the bureaucracy to swallow. And reorganization, and breaking up the departments a little bit, and revitalizing local government, and you know, things that are kind of take away from the federal mystique and the federal power structure tend not to be too popular in this town.
Ask you one more technical question. Your files fully integrated with the government's? And
yes.
Would your work, let's say you drafted a memorandum or dictated a memorandum for Mr. Ehrlichman, would it show as being your work?
No.
Files?
No.
It would show. Not even on a carbon copy?
No. It would be his. And really, since he signed it,
It was his responsibility.
It was his responsibility, so it would not, you know, it was not anything like that. But my files, when he resigned on April 30th, everything our office did as John Ehrlichman, assistant to the president, terminated. And I took everything there and put them in, you know, either central files or into, most of it went to Trudy's office. Because again, let's touch on the filing system for a second, because that's key to what you do. We found that we just didn't have enough room to keep all those files. I mean, there's just no way that we could keep, you know, the president's files on domestic policy. You need an EOB to do it. So basically, we kept in our complex in the West Wing active files, things that were before us constantly or before us all the time. And we only had about four drawers of files. And two were in John's office, which were, we stored his stuff overnight for security reasons. And we needed a drawer and a half just to do that stuff, from his reading to his action items to et cetera. And then Jana had a couple of drawers of, you know, chrono copies and things like, you know, your chrono files and things like that, of memos that have been dictated. On given policy issues, busing, education, labor relations, housing, you know, name it, anything you want, environment, we had our staff divided in 70 areas. All our environmental files were with John Whitaker. And we felt that, you know, there was a decision. We could keep some of the active stuff with us on the environment, and Whitaker could have copies of that and keep everything else. Well, we felt it was just better to keep everything with a guy who had the responsibility. And if we needed it, we could get it awfully fast. It's 200 yards max from, you know, from any file we want to get our hands on.
If Crow would go get it, and get it faster than anybody else can produce it.
That's right. That's right. So what you do is just send, you know, if we needed a file, you know, I'd need to say, give me the file on the EPA regulations from 1970. Whitaker has that. Bammo, send one of the girls over, and I'd call Whitaker and say, she's on her way. It'll be there when she gets it. And we've got it in, you know, 4 minutes. So we kept all our files with the deputy who was charged with a substantive area responsibility. And then if his files became dead, or, you know, closed, or whatever you call them, then he would, you know, send them to central files or whatever they do with them. Cole uses central files a great deal. But again, he's got the luxury of having those of us on his staff maintain, like, I've got the housing files, and they're mine. And when I went from working with John to come into the housing side of the domestic council, I started my own filing system, which I've got here. And if there's anything on housing or Better Communities Act or the housing message and things like that, I've got it. And then, you know, if Ken wants it, he's just got to call, or if Dana wants it, or anybody wants it, they just have to call, and I can get it to them in very short order. So we didn't have a lot of files, and we would periodically go through our files and say, well, these things are no longer really active for us, so send it to Morgan because it's on busing, or send it to Blake because it's on the environment, or it's a Croak thing, it's crime, DC, get it out of here, you know, just taking up space. So our people had their files, and I assume that we've got tabs on them, and they're turning them in or doing whatever they do with them.
You've already touched on what you have been doing since.
We went through a transitional era. He was here till he resigned on the 30th, and he was in and out of the office till like the 20th of May. And then Ken asked me to get together with Dana Mead and go to work on the housing community development side of the policy, which is I was familiar with, given where I was earlier, but I had never really been into a policy area this early and in this depth, starting from the very beginning, really. And so I'm really kind of evolving as a domestic council housing leader. And we have just gone through the housing message and the housing legislation, and we've just completed testimony. The Better Communities Act had already been submitted when I made this switch. But the housing is the other half of what we're considering in the Better Communities area. And so I've been working on that, and I've enjoyed it very much.
Are there any other offices or people on the White House staff with whom you worked very frequently that you haven't already mentioned?
Oh, yeah.
That constantly. Should be.
press office all the time. John was constantly giving guidance on what Ziegler should say, on on given domestic issues. Because he could send a signal to the Hill without us knowing it. And Ron had to know how to posture his response, knowing that he was going to get hit. So I worked with Jerry Warren and Bruce Whalehand and anybody down there that, to get information, and with Ron directly to posture that situation. Worked very closely with every staff secretary we've had here, from Ken Cole, who was the original staff secretary, to John Brown, to Bruce Curlie, to John Huntsman, to, all of those guys, because John was constantly, we were constantly putting things into the president through the staff secretary, and then basically a lot of other people were trying to put things into the president that probably shouldn't go. And the staff secretary needed to be educated to the idea that the president probably shouldn't get a lob in from right field without hearing some of it from left field. And again, it was the honest broker thing. They got a policy memo down there from one of the cabinet officers just to, you got to look at this, Mr. President. They'd give us a call and say, do you want this to go in, or should John put a cover memo on it to give the president the background? It kind of comes out of the blue. So we worked very closely with the staff secretary's office. The appointments to people, all of Haldeman's staff. I mean, I worked closely with Higby, with Bull, who's, is everywhere, because of the daily schedule. John was in and out a great deal, setting up, doing agendas and briefing papers on presidential meetings, cabinet meetings, leadership meetings, and so forth, were pretty much domestic subjects. And because on the domestic side, you have to work so closely with the Congress, or work against them, but you got to work actively one way or the other. Henry was fortunate. He's got to work with about 20 guys up there, and he's pretty much got carte blanche because of the president's constitutional powers on the foreign policy side. We've got no constitutional powers on the domestic side, and everything's got to be in legislation, and that means we've got to work with 535 people, most of whom disagree with us. So most of the meetings that the president had, or many of them, were domestic, and we had to do the agendas, his talking points, the whole thing. So I worked very closely in setting all of that up. And if Ehrlichman was doing briefings, I'd have to do setting up the briefing, often preparing the briefing, so forth, from press briefings to cabinet briefings to leadership briefings and things like that. So. And with the speechwriters, constantly, every speech that the president gave on a domestic subject was cleared by our people and ultimately cleared by Ehrlichman, who had the final say on any domestic speech. Same with messages. All of our writers, we had to work very closely with that. And in constant communication with reviewing their drafts and making small changes, saying, we've got to close this off. As I mentioned earlier, very close contact with the Office of Management and Budget. Normally, when George was there, was George and Cap were the two guys when I was John was there. Worked very closely with them directly and talking to them since they were just down the hall, or with their executive assistants, and with their associate directors, primarily Paul O'Neill and Bill Morrill, working with them as they kind of divided up the domestic spectrum. Constant communication with OMB. We've covered the speech writers, the schedulers, the staff secretary, the OMB, congressional people again. Constant signals, primarily being given by our deputies, the Whitakers, the Probes, the Morgans, that crowd. These guys were constantly talking to our congressional people, and that was the reason for the 7:30 meeting. To make sure that our congressional guys had the substance with which to give signals on the Hill. Or if they needed to have a heavy come up there and talk the technical side of the substance with a congressman in order to get his vote, or educating in order to prepare him, that would mean that we'd have to get together, and sometimes it was John, sometimes it was Cole. More often than not, it was the guys specifically charged with that area of substantive responsibility. Them to go up and make sure that it happened, and that this guy understood where the president was and why. And he didn't have to agree with us, but we could at least agree to disagree. I can't think of anybody with whom I wasn't, except for Henry's guys, and I got close to him. And we do deals on some things with them, DOD, the base crossings to military housing, to, and we, the property review board, we're taking away a lot of DOD's property and turning it into parks. So we did a lot of, you know, I did some dealing with the Hagues and the Scowcrofts and whoever the executive assistant at the time was for Henry. And also when we traveled to San Clemente, Florida, and so forth, Kissinger's people would always travel. It was basically John, Bob, and Henry would travel all the time, and those of us that were with them traveled all the time. So I got to know Kissinger staff very well, or, you know, those guys that traveled immediately with him, and on appropriate issues. And we got into the energy thing and the oil side. There's domestic economic and foreign policy implications that just blow your mind on that one. And I worked very closely with their people. And John did some foreign travel, where we had to coordinate a lot with the NSC and with the State Department. So it was the communication side of it, I suppose, should be squared when you say communication, coordination, administration, because you're communicating with an awful lot of people all the time. And I often wondered if I look back on it, so I regret that I didn't keep phone logs just of who I talked to on a given day. It was, you know, in order to not only take my own calls and either get questions to ask John or give guidance that John had given me or give feel that I might have for a given subject matter, handling all of his calls that I could and returning all of them. And basically you find in these phone calls, which is kind of interesting, that people generally on the telephone call and they're wasting his time. The camera officer will call and say, I gotta talk to Earl. I gotta ask him a question. And you will explain that, look, there's no way, that it could be 9:30 in the morning, there's no way, and I can read his schedule to you, that he's gonna get a call back to you before 4:30 this afternoon. If it's really urgent, you ask me the question, and I'll get you the answer. And that, now, you know, once they found out how that, or they could wait till 4:30 to 8 at night to get the question asked. If, you know, first off, and John was very good and conscientious about returning his calls, but it was just, sometimes you just can't get there from here. A phone is just, sometimes it's a real value, and sometimes it's just a first-class pain. Finally, in working with the cabinet officers, who I got to know well, you know, they would understand that if they could get a question to me, if he was in the president's office, I can get him an answer. But if they don't, you know, I can't assume what their question is. You know, and if you get the guys who say, well, I'll never talk to a staff guy, God damn it. You know, you have to know if you're hung up on who you talk to or if you're hung up on the answer. And, you know, sometimes they learn the lesson the hard way that they didn't get the answer in time. You know, and they had to wing it. Sometimes they made wrong decisions. But that's why, you know, I got paid to be available. And I could always get to Earl. And I looked, we could always get to the president. And that, and, you know, there was no lack of ability for cattle officer to get a question to Earl or the president. No way. You know, they would always say, well, I've got to go out and ask the president personally. You know, what does he want to do on HR1 when the Senate Finance Committee starts to mark it up? Well, you don't have to talk to the president personally about that. The president's guidance is hang tough. You know, why take 20 minutes of his time out of his schedule for him to stroke you and say, hang tough? You know, I get brutal there at times, but I think protecting the president's time is something in order for him to make sound decisions. And, it's a job that I can't imagine any man wanting, but without a high degree of organization and a high degree of discipline, you spend a lot of time running and not getting anywhere. I really admire Richard Nixon for saying, I'm going to spend all my time running, and I'm just going to lap up the distance like mad because I'm going to run after the big ones. And I'm going to hit them, and I'm going to beat them. But I'm not going to let Nickel, I'm not going to get bogged down with 400,000 10-pound weights on my back, each one an answer that either I need not focus on or that somebody else can get. And I think it's the only way that for any president, given his responsibilities, and really handle the task of the presidency, which is immense.
You said we were speaking of time. Just one thing, are there any areas that you would like to just mention as areas that you would like to contribute? to do a more in-depth oral history project?
Say 5 years from now.
Right.
It's a good area. You gotta search out.
I have no idea. I don't know what a, you know, what an in-depth oral history project is. You know, I have through through combat, I guess, I have certain views on how a president should organize himself, or how the policy development process, or the administrative development handling of the president, which I don't know as well as say Larry would, because he was really in the administration side, and you know John in the domestic side, the policy side. But recognizing that all systems that surround, or mechanisms I should say, that surround the president to help him handle the presidency are a function of that man. This president, for example, works best off the written page. Well, your mechanisms then have to be flexible enough to give him a written page. If, you know, and this president does not work from consensus management. Johnson's technique was to take an issue where you had four guys disagreeing, and you all just go down and sit in a room and get a decision. Well, you really get a watered-down, compromised bastardization when you go by consensus management, because everybody gives. It's like the massive compromise. This president decided, I don't want management consensus. I want to know what the options are and who is where and why they're there, and then it's my decision. And when I make a decision, you guys can fight like hell until I make the decision. But when I decide it, you agree with it, and you support it, and you sell it if it takes legislation or a publicity campaign or whatever it is. And that's the kind of organization he set up. That was best for this president, and I think it is best for this president. For the next president, you know, he has to determine what the nature of his work style is. And still have a system. I think we probably have the best system. And I think the presidency, in terms of its operation, will constantly get more sophisticated. It's just, you know, it's just like pro football. It's constantly, defenses are constantly getting better. And it'll constantly get more in terms of the computer and communication and getting information. And we find, you know, as pitiful as it is, the federal government does not have very good information. And that's a surprise. We have very bad information and make leads to very bad decisions. You constantly have to question the source of your information and how valid is your information. That's got to be improved. The computer can help that. I think the way a president can organize himself is something that this president, I think, has done it very well for this president. Whoever the next president is will obviously operate differently, but I think the formation of what is now the Domestic Council, or is now the Office of Management and Budget, and you know, will always have a place in the operation of the presidency. There's got to be, especially until you get reorganization. Now, the Domestic Council, I view as there will always be a Domestic Council staff that will have to provide this function, but it's got to be as large as it is while we don't have reorganization, because we've got 9 departments and we ought to have 4. So, you know, when you get 4, it's a lot easier to coordinate 4 guys than it is 9 guys. And especially when all those 9 guys have bureau heads under them that run off in different directions. When you get reorganization, you know, you can cut your cabinet meeting down to 7 people. Well, that makes coordination just a whole lot easier. And it organizes government along functional lines instead of constituency lines. And that will make coordination a lot easier. We've got the environment, you know, we've got it stuffed in Commerce Department, we've got it stuffed in HUD, we've got it stuffed in HEW, and you know, we have no place that pulls together the environment. Community development I'm in now. Hell, it's everywhere. It's in HEW, it's in the VA, it's in labor, it's in, obviously most of it's in HUD, we've got some in Commerce. You know, and so when trying to address any problem in community development, we've got to pull just about, well, in the housing thing, we had 5 cabinet officers and 3 agency heads who all have a piece of the housing action.
I would like to just ask one more question along this line. The concept of the super cabinet is an interim between what exists and what is proposed in reorganization. Can you pinpoint the originator of that?
My hunch is it's Ehrlichman or President. And I still think that is a very, very valid idea. That, again, is a step. Let me go on again. And before this gets out, I would like to look at the transcript. We had a very large domestic council staff. We had 35 professionals working for Ehrlichman, or something like that, 33. And that was the election organization, and we were damn good. But we, you know, and tying together and coordinating with all the departments and stuff and getting issue papers for an election and radio speeches and stuff, it was a combat team. John or the president decided that it would be, or, you know, they discussed it, and I don't know who originated the discussion. Why not try to reorganize government along functional lines without the legislation? We're going to get some of it, we're not going to get all of it. Why don't we do it anyway? What can we do administratively to pull together all these various departments and agencies, because they're just spread all over hell? So we went through a lot of legal gyrations. We pulled this guy off our staff and had him research the legal stuff and work with the council's office and the Office of Legal Counsel and Justice and pull together what can we do legally. And this is what we were doing from the election until around December 15th at Camp David in Florida, basically is where the president shuttled from. And we found that we could appoint counselors, as we had done before, and we could give them given responsibility. And we're talking on the domestic side now. And that these people could then form committees of the domestic council, which we are now doing again. We just don't have a counselor heading them. We've got Cole heading all of them. And these guys would be cabinet officers of their department, counselors to the president, really assistants to the president. On community development, he called Jim Lynn. Now, Lynn was dealing with, he had labor on there, he had HEW, VA, commerce, transportation, everybody who reflected on community development was on his committee. And that is, whenever the president had a community development problem, he could look to his counselor and say, pull all the entities together and give me a paper on it. And if Lynn was doing that, with his counselor staff, that means we could cut down the domestic council staff, because that's what we did. So I think the concept was very, very valid, and I still think it is. And you know, since it went asunder, and you know, we have had to rebuild up the domestic council to a degree. It's not that the counselor's responsibilities went away; we just did away with the guy who was carrying them out. So the job is still there, and somebody's got to do it. So now that's the job that the domestic council staff is taking on. And it's being done in-house instead of, you know, we're making greater use of the cabinet officer than we did before. And that's very difficult, because they don't know how to, that's a tough problem. They don't know how to bring things unbiasedly to the president.
Who is doing for Cole what you did for Craig?
Craig Gosden, basically.
He's doing that and
John Campbell's.
John
Campbell's? Yeah, the John Campbell, actually, Campbell was organized to the degree that Kathy Jensen, Campbell mechanized everything he did. I mean, he was very organized. And Kathy Jensen is carrying out most of what, you know, a lot of what he did. And Craig takes part of it, and Carol Patrick takes part of it. And then among the three of them, they can cover the responsibilities that John had, Campbell had. And then Craig is kind of doing the work that I did for Ken.
Would the domestic council file and have copies of all the cabinet committees and task force reports and some of the working papers, or they go back into?
They ought to have. I don't know. I mean, I've just gone through one from beginning to end, which is the housing task force or domestic council. It's the domestic council committee on community development.
And
we focused on the housing thing, which required a very lengthy, you know, three separate decision memoranda to the president, and then the drafting of the messages and the fact sheets and the legislation. Lynn probably has the most complete, well, I don't know, I guess I probably got the most complete things. He's got many of his decision papers were reviewed here, and then we went back to him and he had to rewrite them. again, to just, you know, the way the president would like things presented to him.
Where did you get the file, though? Was here?
Well, I started, well, on that one, we started from scratch. HUD started with a big study on housing, and they took that and drew certain conclusions. From that, it's kind of like where we are now, and then you have to say, where do we want to be? That's the policy call. And then how do we get there from here? That's, you know, that's the interim, short-term versus the long-term call. And how do we focus on legislation and plugging into that, you know, realistic budget projections? You know, you just kind of pull it all together. And Lynn did much of that, working with Paul O'Neill and OMB and myself and Dana.
We should probably mention.
Well, answering your question on other subjects, I have no idea. I mean, I...
We may think of a few more, thinking back over this hour and a half, and see if we can come back again in a week.
Sure, sure. Well, give me a call. I'd be happy to work something out.
Thank you.
Good to see you.